Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, joined by psychologist and best-selling author Dr. James Dobson. Today, we continue the conversation with Senator Rick and Karen Santorum. Mm-hmm.
Karen, when we were talking yesterday, one of the first things you said was that you get a lot of phone calls from mothers and fathers who have disabled children. Some of them, I guess, shortly after the birth of a child, and the implications for life with a special needs child are looming before you. What do you tell those parents when they're shocked and they're stunned and they realize what is going to be a long road for them in some cases?
Yes, so much of it, Dr. Dobson, is just loving them and knowing how painful a time they're going through. I think when you share an experience, even though the facts are different, the situations are very different, the fact is the pain is the same, and that heartache of a mother or a father, and they just want to talk to someone who's been there, who shared that journey. And so we just will, and if they're, you know, Christian, we'll pray together. And a lot of it, too, is just that, you know, when they ask for advice, we just share what we went through. And then we all guide each other. Rick and I received so much of that from other parents, and we will be eternally grateful for that. Just so much of the help we got was from other parents.
Well, one of the big things, Karen mentioned this earlier, is the fact that the medical community is not encouraging them in any way, shape, or form. If there is a diagnosis of trisomy 18 in particular, or trisomy 13, or some of these other very severe genetic disorders, the medical community really does, you know, encourage abortion and then non-treatment, basically not providing any kind of care, and even other than palliative care, just to sort of basically keep them alive. But the expectation is, as it was with Bella, I mean, when they sent us home with Bella after 10 days in the neonatal intensive care unit, or NICU, we were sent home on hospice care. The expectation was she was going to die, and we were simply going to, you know, make her comfortable until she did die. And, you know, we had some incidents occur during hospice that were not, let's say, just were not positive. And we decided, you know what, we're not going to sit and consider this, you know, waiting for her to die, but we were going to do everything we could to have her life be a long and beautiful and wonderful life. And so we ended hospice care, and we just decided we were going to focus on every moment we had
and do well baby visits.
And she first came home, we were so convinced by all the medical literature and by the doctors that she was going to die, and it was only going to be a matter of, you know, weeks or months, that we actually had birthdays for her every week.
Every day,
and then we did every week, and we wanted to have our belief was that if we had as many weeks, birthdays as we would expect our normal kids to have, our other kids to have in years, we would be in great shape. And then she kept confounding, and she was doing great, and we just never knew, and we just kept living every day and making the most of it.
And our pediatrician was great. He came and did house visits. And we were just so thankful for that.
I was going to ask you, have you had a difficult time finding a supportive pediatrician in your area?
Our pediatrician has been great, and we had a difficult time. The most challenging time, I think, in a lot of these children's lives is the first year, because you're getting to know that child. You're getting to know what the medical issues are and how to best take care of them. And you're also building up a team of physicians who are going to love and support and fight for your child. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting first 10 months of Bella's life, and we thank God, because Bella is surrounded by the most excellent team of physicians and therapists. But navigating that road initially was sort of shocking, to be honest with you. At times we could tell you stories that would just shock you. I guess one of the biggest is and I know hospice is beautiful, I know they do a lot of good, so I don't want to say anything bad about them, but for us personally, we had a really bad experience with them. They prescribed what would have been a lethal dose of morphine.
Oof.
And I thank God we had it double checked. Our pediatrician, we asked them to double check that dose. I mean, as a NICU nurse, I know morphine can be therapeutic if you're having an arrest situation, but it also can be lethal if it's too high.
Yes.
And that was a weird moment. And we had so many things happen, oh my goodness, along the way. And these stories that we had happen are very common when parents are fighting for their special needs kids.
And it really is a fight. I mean, you're not, I wholeheartedly understand what you're saying, because I've had patients come to me, you know, literally sort of saying, help, doctors are telling me that I should do this, what should I do? And that anywhere from my doctor's telling me to abort this child to let them go and die. And you, it's embarrassing as a physician. I'm ashamed to say that there aren't more physicians out there fighting.
No, thank God you're out there, Meg. And yeah. You sound like my sister. She's a pediatrician, and she says the same thing that you say. Thank God you're out there. We need to multiply you because it makes such a big difference. And so many times, whether these children live or die, it really is the physicians and how they're guiding them.
So it's a double-edged sword in the sense today, and Meg is a physician, this is why we're so grateful for you and for others like you, because as Jim has fought his entire career against the devaluing of human life, which is obvious in our society, and particularly looking at, you know, the child in the womb and particularly a child with disabilities, throw on top of that the increasing government involvement in medicine and budgets.
Yes.
So it's now, you know, what are we going to spend these precious resources on?
Oh, yeah.
And should we be spending money on these children who aren't going to be useful to society, or not going to be, you know, helpful to the economy, and or be able to pay taxes? And so you have this double-edged sword of devaluing life generally, and then budgets on top of it for how we treat disabled
children.
Well,
we felt that when Bella was, she got pneumonia at 6 months, and she was on a ventilator, and eventually the doctor wanted to discontinue ABGs, arterial blood gases. Well, having been a NICU nurse, I confronted him and asked him about that, and I said, you can't do that. She's on a ventilator. Those numbers are essential for knowing what the ventilator setting should be. He was taken back that I asked him about it, and then I asked him if he knew Bella's name. Even know her name.
Wow.
And basically then after a conversation, he admitted this was all about money. So anyway, right after that, I literally arranged myself to transfer her out of this particular hospital that she was in. And we just always go right up to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. They're just great. They've taken great care of her. And I'll never forget a doctor up there saying, trisomy 18 kids today are like trisomy 21 kids 50 years ago. And he said, how are we going to know what they're capable of if we don't give them a chance, if we don't fight for them?
Absolutely.
And he said, let's face it, if you put a healthy baby in the corner of a NICU and you don't feed it, even a healthy baby's going to die. So it's a beautiful world, but it's also a very sad world. I have days where Rick says, you know, honey, you probably shouldn't talk to any parents today, because it's hard, because you hear their stories and it just makes you weep.
Many parents are out there listening and are very, very frightened. Maybe they have a special needs child, or they have a pregnancy and they're anticipating a problem. And they say, well, what can I do? I'm not in the medical community. I'm not a neonatal intensive care unit nurse. I'm not a physician. And I would encourage those people, you can find one physician, an internist or a pediatrician in your community, to go to bat for your child, to be that inside person to help you navigate this. Because, as you said, Senator, it's going to be harder in the future because money's involved. And as you were saying, Mrs. Santorum, you know, you have to kind of know what's happening. But I would encourage you, if you interview a pediatrician and they're not on your side, go to another and another and another.
Yeah, keep changing. Yes, that's great advice. And I think the internet is a great resource. It's so funny because as parents, Rick and I, we just fight to limit screens with our kids. But the internet is a wonderful thing when you have a child with disabilities, because it helps you to connect. It helps you to find other parents and groups that will give you the guidance and advice and help you on your journey.
What about Obamacare and the implications for funding? You talk about money, and we've heard about death panels. That makes people angry, but I believe that's what's coming, because somebody is going to sit in Washington and say, this person can be treated, this one is too old, this one may be disabled. And that really rankles me. Are you worried about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons I ran for president in 2012, was to stop Obamacare. I mean, some of the most horrific stories that we hear with the network of parents that we've been introduced to are from Canada. The treatment up there is just, it's absolutely horrific. I mean, they simply refuse to care. They deny treatment. Story after story of lying to parents about the child's condition. And, you know, the recourse to a parent who has their child basically euthanized by lack of treatment is minimal in Canada. They don't have the litigation system that we have here. So for us, this battle on Obamacare is really a battle for all those who are not the healthy fit of the country, but those who are either chronically ill or have disabilities, because you mentioned death panels, but the only way Obamacare fits this cost containment model, there's nothing in Obamacare that contains cost, nothing, except rationing care. And, of course, when you come to rationing care, the decision's going to be made on who are the healthiest, the fittest, the best able to recover, as opposed to someone who is either chronically ill and doesn't have very much chance of recovery, or someone who's disabled and doesn't, quote, add to society, are the ones who are going to be winnowed out.
So far, you have not had to fight that, though.
Well, we've had to fight for care. I mean, Karen can give you a lot of stories. If we've had, you know, she gave you the one on the when she was in the intensive care unit. But no,
there's 100 others. Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
There is already and I'm sure Meg will back us up on this, a notion among physicians that, you know, there's limited resources, and, you know, these children, you know, they're not going to be around very long, or, you know, they're not going to be very valuable, and therefore we shouldn't be spending resources, you know, on this. And it's happened to us. And I can tell you, we've heard lots of stories from other families who've confronted the same.
Yeah. And unfortunately, many times physicians make those decisions without even telling parents there's a decision to be made.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they will just go and take it, the responsibility for not treating the child or not maximizing the ventilator or doing that, rather than saying to the parent, you know, we could this or we could that. They'll just do it on their own. And, you know, that's sadly, I think that's just going to get worse in the future, because really Obamacare is all about ensuring the healthy. It's not a program that helps the sick. It is a program that is for the healthy. That's why they want all these young people to sign up. And
that is really scary. And that ought to be frightening for every person who's getting older and looks ahead and may already have cardiac problems or who knows what else. And somebody's going to be sitting up there in Washington deciding that your life isn't worth living. Man, I can't accept that.
No.
Same here.
Well, that's why socialized medicine, you know, you look at the countries where it's, quote, popular. Well, it's popular because, as Meg said, most of the people in the country are healthy. And so if it's designed around healthy, you get lots of well visits and you get all these little minor treatments that don't cost a lot of money. Everybody gets taken care of. It's free. Everybody feels really great. Except, of course, you get sick. And then when you get sick, you don't get care. You get put in waiting lines and people die. And people don't get the kind of care that they're – well, if you die, then your vote doesn't count anymore. And so if you have a system that doesn't do a very good job of treating the sick and doesn't keep the sick around very much, you know, if people die in shorter periods of time, then there's fewer people to complain about the how bad the system is.
Exactly. Mm. Can I ask just sort of turn the corner a little more personal question as a mother? And how do you live with the unknown, the uncertainty, that tension that at any day Bella could turn? Mm. That must be extremely hard to live with, and I just wondered, how do you live with that?
You know, it really is all faith, and it's just that complete trust in God. I know He loves Bella even much more than we do. Mm-hmm. And we love her like crazy, and it's hard. I really, there was a little period of time when I was sort of focused on that she was going to die, but then I have to remember, I let it go, and I just want to enjoy and immerse and celebrate her life literally every single day. And I just pray for God's hand upon her. I pray that He will keep her healthy and protect her, and He has. And I have to remember that if that day comes, well, when that day comes, I hope it's a long, long time from now, that I have to remind myself she's going straight to heaven, and that's the goal for all of us. We're here on this earth to go to heaven. It's hard. I mean, I've struggled with it. I mean, the hardest times for me is when, I love taking care of Bella, so I'm here every day, and I take care of her, and it's wonderful. And her doctors have all said she really should have a full-time 24/7 nurse. And I said, she does.
Your mom.
It's me, and it's Rick, and my kids, and my babysitter. But the hardest times is when Bella gets sick and Rick is away. And my one prayer is, Lord, please don't take her on my watch. I can't handle that.
You know,
a little private prayer.
Karen and Rick, you know that I wrote about you in a chapter in my book, Bringing Up Boys.
It's a great book. I love it.
So impressed by the two of you and of your attitude toward children. And Karen, you are one incredible mother. I have interviewed you in the studio. I know how you go about training your children. You know, not to promote my book, but I would really like people who have been touched by this conversation yesterday and today to get my book just for that chapter and read about this family and how they feel about Bella. And I also said about you, Karen, I probably embarrassed you with this, but I was so impressed with you that I knew that, Senator, you had ambitions to run for president. And I said at that time, I wrote at that time, that, Karen, you would make one incredible first lady. Do you remember me saying about that?
And I still believe it. That's so kind of you.
Well,
I'm glad you think that.
Absolutely true.
Well, that's very, very sweet.
There are some examples in there of your telling stories to your children, the classics. Describe that. It's sort of off the topic, but it really isn't.
Oh, Rick and I have always loved reading stories to the children as they get older and talking. Now that they're older and reading books all on their own, just talking about the stories and the morals of the stories or the heroes and who they'd like to model. And I think that they serve as great role models to kids at all stages of life. And you have the good and the bad and the good versus evil and so many great stories to use.
Yeah, in the world of the anti-heroes of the popular culture, you know, we really believe it's important for them to have role models, not just in real life, if you will, but throughout history and in fiction, where you see virtue and you understand the role that virtue plays in someone's life, as opposed to, you know, the anti-virtuous, anti-hero behavior of a lot of what we see coming out of popular culture today.
And reading, you know, I admire you so much. We did a similar kind of thing with our kids as they were growing up and read them the classics at bedtime. But to expose kids to great literature, great minds, great philosophies, and it stimulates a lot of really good conversation that a lot of children aren't getting these days as they're growing up because, you know, the internet has replaced so much. So I just so admire you for bringing that to your children.
You know, when we're talking about the classics, I'm reminded of C.S. Lewis's Shadowlands. I don't know if you saw the movie about that. It's one of my favorite movies. But the theme of that book, Shadowlands, is that to love is to expose yourself to pain and loss because living and caring and loving for people makes you vulnerable. And so he dealt with the issue of would it be better not to love at all to protect yourself from that pain, or is it better to love and that the pain and the loss is part of living? And he concluded that the latter is better. You have obviously drawn the same conclusion, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. I read his Grief Observed after Bella's birth, and it really moved me because that was the message. And he had that love, and he hurt so badly after he had lost his wife. And it's so true. It's better to love and to feel that, and even though you are opening up your heart to a lot of hurt.
And that's, I guess, the message when, you know, you see so many people who are dealing with a diagnosis of a child who has a disability, sometimes profound, sometimes minor, and they feel, well, we just can't handle this. I mean, we can't handle the, you know, losing the child. We can't handle the pain of dealing with all these complications. And the answer is, yes, you can. God doesn't give you something that you can't deal with, and that you just need to accept His will, and you need to embrace that challenge and that cross, and that He'll give you. Just like, I never forget when we had our second child, we found out we were pregnant with our second child. I thought, how can we have another child? I can't possibly love that child as much as I love our first one. And you know what? He gives you the ability for your love to grow, and that your ability to love more is needed. And so I just say to all those parents, just, you know, trust Him and be faithful, and He will give you the grace you need.
Let me ask you a really delicate question. I'm sure you've thought of it. Have you considered the possibility of Bella outliving the two of you? And what then? That would worry me if I had a youngster like that.
It does. And our prayers that she'll go with the last of us.
Our last
and our children get so
great.
Upset when we say that, because they love her so much. Mom, Dad, we'll take care of Bella. So we've done things to set up, I don't know, whatever, trust funds or something. But it is a concern, you know. But
the kids have been right there saying that, you know, don't worry, that there would be a battle as to who would get Bella.
I think they love her so much, and they've been so, so great with Bella. And it's interesting because I look at these families of the siblings. When a family has a special needs child, and I look at the siblings, and my heart is just so touched by them, because it's almost like they love even more. They grow up quicker in a really good way because they learn virtue, and they learn more responsibility. And they're just really great kids.
They learn that life isn't just about them, too, which is another beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yep. It's a wonderful lesson. I've experienced that as well. As I think back on my patients that have older siblings, the older siblings really pitch in and help and become very protective of these youngsters. As Bella's growing up, do your kids, are they hands-on helpers? Are they,
goodness. They know all of her care. But it's funny, and I've done this with each and every one of my kids. I was one of 12 kids, and I think you have to be so careful not to do too much.
Right.
So they babysit, but we've always protected them. I've always said I never want Bella to be sick or have something happen while they're in their care. So we're always very careful with, you know, making sure they babysit her only if she's healthy and it's a short time. But it's the sweetest thing. Every day they can't wait to hold her and play with her and play piano and just have her with them. They read her books. And, you know, it's just a funny thing because anytime I'm busy or I need to make dinner, I'll say, can someone hold Bella? And I have five kids lined up wanting to hold her. It's the sweetest thing. It's never an issue.
They've
really been great with her. It's a beautiful thing to see.
Mm. Meg, do you see why I love these people?
Yes, I do. I'll tell you, I could talk with them for a couple more hours here. It's so inspiring. So
to
inspiring.
To see their family in action is a thing of beauty. We are out of time again. These two programs went by so fast. I just thank you for the modeling again that you're doing for other families. And Karen, how do people reach you? I don't want to overwhelm you, but how do people reach you if they're really struggling with a special needs child?
They can reach Karen at patriotvoices.com, which is our website for the Karen and I set up. An organization about almost 2 years ago now to really fight for all of the issues that Karen and I care passionately about, everything from the life issue to marriage to making sure that we're safe and secure as a country. And if you go to the Patriot Voices website and you contact us, and if you're someone who wants to talk to Karen or me or mom or dad who's going through a difficult time with a child, we would be more than happy to respond. So we monitor that website, and we monitor the email that comes in, and we'll make sure that we get back to you very, very promptly.
We're talking to Senator Rick Santorum, his wife Karen, who has brought 8 children into the world. One of them's in heaven, and another one is celebrating her 6th birthday, when a lot of people would not have expected her to live this long. It must be quite a celebration. You going to have a birthday party today?
We're we're having a princess party. It's so funny. Bella is so spoiled, but it's hilarious because she doesn't know it.
She's not aware.
She's the one
spoiled.
Child we can spoil.
So we're having
a princess party.
I ask our listeners to be in prayer for you and your family.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Come see us here in Colorado Springs if you get an opportunity.
Thank you.
It's a tough trip. It's not one of the most beautiful places in the world, but we'll try to.
Oh yeah, come on! All we've got's a 14,000-foot mountain in our backyard. So.
It's gorgeous.
Beautiful.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Okay,
love it. Yeah.
I love you both.
Blessings to you. God bless you.
Bye bye.
Well, what a powerful story about life. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, and if you would like more information about the ministry here at Family Talk, you can call us at 877-732-6825 or visit our website, drjamesdobson.org. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again next time right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.